Today's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
War vote ahead. The markets break their four-week losing streak. And Japan gets the 2020 Olympics. We also have Das, the author of Extreme Money, on this show, and plenty more to cover on episode number 329 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, this episode, and I'm glad to have you. It is now September. We are a week or so into September, and we saw a nice little move to the positive side on markets because, well, it was the beginning of the month. There was some question in there about the war. We had some things that looked better. For example, at the end of the week, for a little while there, it looked better at least. We had some employment numbers that looked better. Manufacturing was much better, and the service index came out much better than expected. So there's a lot of things that are happening economically that look a little bit twisted because we're seeing some better things in some areas, and it's flipping a bit. Manufacturing was really problematic for a while, and we saw some things like the factory orders, et cetera, starting to slip and show some problems with that. Now we're seeing some of that turn around. The big question is going to be, how is retail faring? This week we're going to be having, at the end of the week, the retail sales number along with a few other things, but really the important matter of the week is going to be the economic number on retail sales because there has been a perception that we are going to see a slowdown in retail, and it's just trickling through. Many of the retailers are now offering tremendous amounts of discounts and a variety of lower costs to entice people into the stores, and that usually does not show up very well for overall earnings. We saw many of the teen retailers have a lot of problems recently, and we've also seen some of the other big box stores starting to show that their outlook is much lower than it had been expected, and their stocks, of course, have been affected. Whatever the reason, because you know you have to look at what's the sentiment? What are they thinking, the consumer? Is there an issue with money, outlook? What is it? Because right now we're seeing that consumer confidence maintains at a pretty high level. At the same time, we're seeing that housing prices are still holding in very nicely. Stock markets are holding. So you got the wealth market, that's wealth effect of the market, that's kind of giving a nice underlying bid to things. At the same time, you wonder, well, what happened with the sequestration and what happened with the excessive amount of funds that were taken out due to taxes? And what about this whole thing about gas prices? Because if you look at gas prices, we've seen another increase as oil topped 110 on Friday over Syrian fears and potential war in the Mideast. How does that affect things? Well, there's a certain line, and that's not always defined, but there's going to be a line when gas prices move to a level that's just too high for people to afford. And that then shows up in transportation costs, in not only personal transportation, but in the cost for FedEx, UPS, you know, all the different functionalities of the business that rely on trucking and various transportation and airlines to have prices that will be supportive of reasonable amount of pricing for themselves so that they can get margin benefit. And if they're going to be passed on by FedEx, by the airlines, et cetera, truckers to the retailer, manufacturer, well, they're going to either do one of two things. They're going to increase their prices, or what's going to happen is they're going to start losing money comparatively. Their profitability goes down. If the prices aren't passed along, well, then you have the profitability problem with the transportation companies. So when you look at this, you have to kind of figure out long-term what's going to happen. I'll tell you already that I've seen some recent FedEx pricing on things that we had sent out, and I was pretty shocked how aggressively they've increased pricing in a very short period of time. How long will it be till people say, you know what, forget about this FedEx thing. I'm going to do whatever I can, paperless, email, maybe even faxes, who knows, or some other kind of mechanism. Now, obviously, that's a problem when it comes to goods. You can't ship anything that is bigger than a piece of paper via electronic means. It just can't happen unless they come up with a shrinkerator or something like that. But goods can't be shipped that way. You can't use electronic mechanisms. So there's still always going to be a market, but the question is there an alternative? Will people accept a slower delivery? Probably not. Well, let's talk about a few things before we get to our guest today that are going to be very important. We did see that the markets did, in fact, break their four-week losing streak, which was good. And we did see that a bit of a recovery off of last month's, the worst month, really, we've seen in a very long time, a year and a half or so. And some of that was due to the fact that there was less of a concern about the war in Syria as President Obama passed that decision on to Congress, which now is a total mess because Congress can't figure out what to do. And now the cat's out of the bag and going back on it's a problem. But the big issue happened on Friday. If you watch the intraday movement of the markets on Friday, there was something that very, very concerning took place. And that was that while the unemployment came in at about 7.3%, because we do have the lowest participation rate in years, decades, and while the number that came in was about 160,000, so a little bit light, but there was revisions backward the last 2 months, taking 75,000 people out of the workforce. Well, there was a bid on that, thinking that, maybe the Fed's going to stay a little bit longer because the obsession of the markets with the Fed is crazy. But then right at 9:30, there was just a tremendous drop-off in futures and markets, and everything just really started turning around very fast, free-falling. And that was on the heels of a comment from Russia's Putin, who said that, we're going to continue to supply Syria with weapons and back them, even if the U.S. strikes or comes in any way. Now, if you take that and translate that, what that means is that we no longer would be waging war or an action against Syria, but indirectly with Russia. That's not good. That's just not a healthy thing. And now all of a sudden we have much of the world saying they really don't want to go in. And if you look at the votes in Congress and you look at the outcry from the public, it looks like there's a big problem. And particularly there's a big problem with the plan that was presented, which is a couple of strategic strikes on maybe some chemical weapons areas and to get rid of those and the manufacturing of those. And that's it. It's not sending any soldiers in. So markets were really jittery on that and that whole Russian comment. And then, they kind of got over it a bit, rose up from the bottom very quickly, so thinking that, okay, well, we're not going to have a war anyway. Let's get reality here. If it's anything, it's just going to be a punishment to Syria. Which, by the way, I always wondered, if you bomb a chemical weapons depot that has chemical weapons that are in there somehow, doesn't that then advance the spread of the chemical? I don't understand. Don't you want it to kind of like take that in its whole part and bury it somewhere or do something with it and get it out of an area that can be contaminated? Anyway, so now here we have a situation where, okay, maybe there's not going to be a big issue, and okay, they're supplying to Syria by Russia. Markets came back a bit, and at the end of the day, they just collapsed, back to the zero line. So a big move, though. It was a few hundred points in each direction move on the markets on all this, and you're going to continue to see some of this, at least the volatility related to the whole idea of, are we going to have an action in Syria or not over the next week or so when Congress is debating and talking about this, and at the same time as President Obama and proponents of going into Syria are working on a campaign to sway public opinion. And if you saw that this weekend where they came out with a classified documents of videos that were put under wraps for a while, only showed to those people in Congress, et cetera, that had certain clearance, and they were released to the public showing all of these people dead, dying, children, all of the streets, apparently from some kind of a gas, and it was said to be sarin gas was the issue that was really going on there. And that's going to happen over the next week or so. This, you're going to see all sorts of protests and commentary and videos, and it's going to be it's going to be a mess, to be honest with you. You know, I don't know why some of this is not just dealt with at the upper ends and not put on not only Congress but on the public, because we elected these officials to do what they're supposed to do. But that's neither here nor there. We can't really argue it, because it is going to be a simple process these days of debate, and we'll see what happens there. But I will tell you that I am against the whole idea of offshooting this and putting this off on Congress at this time. We'll see. But let's talk about a couple other things. Number one, economics for the week, like I mentioned, there's only going to be a few things of importance. Let's see some PPI coming out. We'll see if inflation's perking up a little bit. But all eyes are going to be on the war, retail, or whatever's happening in Syria, retail sales towards the end of the week, as well as we're going to be having further discussion about the Fed and the potential for tapering at the next meeting. Big issue right there. There was a couple of things otherwise that I want to talk to you about. There was a great article maybe it wasn't an article, I would call it an editorial, that was in the New York Times last week. If you didn't catch it, it was pretty cutting, and it was not really putting Larry Summers in the best light. And it was a commentary about Summers being the wrong choice for Fed chairman. Now, let me just kind of go through this with you. I think it was really fascinating. So New York Times board said in this editorial that he has an abysmal record on financial regulation and hasn't acknowledged the errors. His reputation is replete with evidence of temperament unsuited to be Fed chairman. Putting Summers in charge would risk institutional discord or worse, dysfunction. In the 1990s, he was instrumental in deregulating derivatives and in repealing Glass-Steagall banking laws. He was wrong in saying it wouldn't result in any, you know, that the financial crisis was unforeseeable, because it wasn't. He has shown an indifference in how economic decisions affect ordinary people, the opposite of what is needed in a Fed leader during times of high unemployment. And in the first Obama term, he belatedly supported the Volcker Rule reforms to curb bank size, recklessness, and a rule not yet in place. So the New York Times is definitely not in favor of Larry Summers. And much of what they have said, and a little bit more, is the sentiment that I've really proposed. I mentioned this. I said that Summers, I don't think, really is the best choice for the Fed. You maybe have to look at... maybe you're going to look up the Yellen or other people, but right now I just don't see it as something that's really going to be beneficial overall. I also want to mention that the bank that has been a big problem for Italy, the Monte Paschi, which has been a real thorn in the side because they had all sorts of wrongdoings and problems in the banking and various divisions. Seems like they're going to get another $2.5 billion, which they got backing of a total of about $5.4 billion. They would try to raise some more money. You know, there's all this money that's going to be flooded in again. So just to kind of set the record straight here, when it comes to the Italian and much of the European banking system that has been in focus for a long time, although it really nobody's caring about it these days because you have the promise of the ECB saying, hey, we'll take care of everything. There's still a lot of problems there. Now, the good news is that still the European Union is committed to, and the Italian government still committed to giving all sorts of money to the banks. It's just a nonstop event. So the bank is going to try to raise some money somehow, and they're going to then get the total of about $5.4 billion. The same thing's happening in Greece, by the way. There was a commentary that Greece would like to take some write-downs. We'll probably get to some of this with Das. But Greece would like to take some write-downs, and they also need another billion or so. So it seems like they're going to be getting their money moving forward. But the crisis there is really not over. Now, finally, on economics and international, China's exports rose about 7.2%, which is really good because the expectations were for about 5.5%. Now, the problem was that their imports only rose about 7%, and they expected about 11.5% rise. And that was very light. So even though we're not sure whether we can trust these numbers at this point, because we have seen that China clearly had a problem and has a problem with misrepresentation of their imports and exports, right now on paper, the numbers look a little bit better. So that's, is it good to see? Is it bad to see? It is. It's simply a fact on paper, and we'll go from there. But I think you have to be very careful what you look at there. I want to mention that the trigger charts, we had that webinar last week. You can find the replay of that webinar. It's about 30 minutes talking about the various indicators. And take a look at that. We'll have also information on our show notes for this particular episode. And also, I appeared on Investor Business Daily's radio show this week. And you can listen to that over on Investors Business Daily, investors.com. Or you can go over to our site we have on The Disciplined Investor. We also have a link to listen to it. I thought it was a great interview until I heard it. It was a very good interview. The only problem was my volume must have been on plus 10 because I don't know what happened with the recording. Everything seemed to sound good while we were doing the audio checks and all, but I was terribly overmodulated. Terribly overmodulated. a big degree. It was really quite unbelievable. Anyway, so I do want to mention, I mentioned at the top of the show, we're back with our friends over at audible.com. And if you haven't had the opportunity, whether it's on your iPad, iPhone, or your Android device, or whatever you listen to, you can get some great books on audible.com. And the fact is, you can get it for free. There's so many books. There's hundreds of thousands of titles that are available on Audible. And I love it because it makes it so much easier to multitask, essentially. You can listen to a book and you can do other things. And, you know, you don't have to lug around a big book with you. And even if you're using the paper books that are on your device, this is still a great way because sometimes the inflection in the voices, the information that you get is just terrific. There's bestsellers on there like The Eye of the Needle by Ken Follett and Never Go Back, Solaris, 50 Shades of Grey, if you want to listen to that in a book. But one of the ones I want to mention was a book by Stephen Covey called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And it is a wonderful book because it gives you all sorts of tips and tools and ways in which to really make yourself not only more effective, more efficient, and it does it much differently than some of the other books. A lot of books will tell you, hey, you got to write this down and give yourself a daily list, and then you need to then refer to it and write it back again and then review it every night. There's some of that in there, but basically it's a psychology, and it's a wonderful tool with a lot of different examples, and I've listened to it several times. Way back, I've attended a couple of the courses, actually, of Stephen Covey. This is something that I really encourage you to check out, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. All you have to do, you get it free, by the way. This is the best part. Get it for free at audiblepodcast.com/discipline. That's audiblepodcast.com/discipline. And the nice thing is you get a 30-day free trial. Well, let's get to our guest and see what he has to say, because I'm interested, and he always brings some really good information to us, and I'm sure today is going to be no difference. I always read all the work he does. Brilliant writer, brilliant speaker. Let's get to Das. Back with us again is Das, Sanjay Das, and he is a good friend and a favorite of the show, of course, and listeners. And he is the author of Extreme Money, a prolific writer, and he has consulted to some very high-powered and influential folks in the government and all that about fixed income, and has a very extreme background and deep background in finance, and particularly with very interesting fixed income. So, Das, how are you?
Good. I'm fine.
Great.
Glad to see that everybody's getting to work after their summer break. It's almost like school's back.
Yeah, it is school's back. As a matter of fact, I was saying that, you know, in, I don't know when they start in Australia, but in Florida, we start high school like August 20th.
Okay. No, in Australia, it's this February.
February.
Oh, yeah. We're upside down, you know.
You get the toilets that the water goes backwards, right?
Exactly. Everything goes the wrong way.
There's a lot of things I want to talk to you about because there's so many things that are happening that are peripherally related to the whole the way things are going in the United States. Now, we know the United States is the number one economy in the world. Okay. So we're seeing that from inside the U.S., things look pretty good. You know, we got some decent economic numbers, or at least better. We got the continuation of stimulus. We have all these things that are happening. Okay, great. But yet, we don't really see, because we sometimes isolate ourselves as investors, the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is telling a different story, in particular, the emerging markets, right?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. But just coming back to the thing about the United States, it's interesting. Because you're absolutely correct. The United States has done better. Because I think there are a couple of things people forget. If you're going to have a bad crisis, you should have it first. And they did. And they moved aggressively to do certain things like recapitalize banks and so forth, all of which has paid some dividends. But I think when you look at the growth story, it's a little bit illusory. Because let's say you're growing at 2%. If you assume the U.S. economy is, say, give or take $16 trillion, that's about $300 billion a year in additional output. But to create that, you need the government to run a fiscal deficit of around about $600 billion, plus you need the Fed to put in about $85 billion a month, to say $1 trillion. So you're putting in $1.6 trillion to get out $300 billion. So people need to keep in mind that there is a degree of artificiality in the growth numbers. And I think the real issue is this sustainable? So when you take away those props, what's going to happen? And to be honest, none of us know that. And the other thing is, the U.S. has very, very carefully managed to not only improve its export competitiveness in terms of the lower dollar, but what it's actually done is export a lot of its problems. Because as you were talking about with the emerging markets, what we're now seeing is an unwinding and a very unpleasant side effect of what the U.S. did. And indeed, so did the U.K., so did Japan, so did a lot of economies, which basically pumped out a lot of money. And that money's gone into the emerging markets. And as the developed markets improve, the money's flowing back to developed markets, but out of emerging markets. And that's what we're seeing in the emerging market complex, is this withdrawal of liquidity is having some very, very nasty side effects. And I think it's not putting too fine a point on it to say that the conditions look remarkably similar to the conditions in the middle to late 90s, when, of course, we had the Asian monetary crisis and the Russian defaults. So I don't know whether it'll get that bad, but it's looking ugly to me.
You know, it's fascinating because one of the big things that, you know, that you mentioned here is one of the point you say that, well, there's X amount of trillions going in, and the net effect is, you know, a plus X amount of billions. That tells me there's a hole in the boat.
Well, I think it's like pouring water into a bucket with a lot of holes.
Yeah,
if you keep pouring it water, it looks full. And that's, I think, part of the issue. I don't think anybody, even the policymakers, would disagree if you said that you don't have a sustainable recovery. I was interested to see Mario Draghi, the European Central Bank president, last night to basically water down all this thing about a European renaissance and recovery. He was very, very downbeat. And I think to some extent, I think that was understandable because he doesn't want yields to back up on the basis that there's been a recovery. But I think he's also, to some extent, being truthful, saying we don't have a sustainable recovery at all.
But it's very difficult to separate the two. I mean, you know, central bankers talk their book. I mean, that's what you would say if any mutual fund manager or company CEO came on a talk show, was allowed to speak freely to the world. They talk their book to move things in the direction they want to move it. And it's very difficult to discern what is really the case because I think they have to carefully think about what they're going to say. And if they say things like, hey, the economy is really doing well, because the markets have been so trained to think that, okay, withdrawal of stimulus equals stocks down or yields up are very bad for things in general, He talks like this, and it's the effect is to benefit, you know, his own situation.
Well, I think it's very interesting because sitting outside the United States, I found this discussion about the tapering, which has been going on for the last 2 months, to be quite surreal. Because firstly, Bernanke gets asked whether he is going to wind this back. Now, given that he's already said, and everybody said, this is all temporary, what else would you be expecting him to say? He'd have to say that basically he's going to withdraw this at some stage. The second thing is This is his grand strategy for creating a sustainable recovery. So if he says he's not going to withdraw it, then people would start to ask him questions like, so isn't it working? So it's entirely predictable what he said. Also, to be honest, Bernanke's not going to be in the chair when all this happens. So he's playing for his place in history. He doesn't want to be seen as the guy who left the spigots on for just a little too long. So all of this is highly predictable. And remember, you know, people should have a cold shower and have a think about this, because all he's saying is he's going to taper, which means he's going to reduce the size of the purchases.
Mm-hmm.
And even after this, he's going to be purchasing substantial amounts. Then the balance sheet of the Fed holds a huge amount of mortgage-backed securities and government bonds. He hasn't said he's going to sell any of it as yet, which would be cause for considerable concern in markets. Also, he's made it very clear over and over again that he has no intention of increasing short-term rates anytime soon. So it's kind of puzzling as a, you know, intelligent Martian sitting in Australia, sort of going, well, what's the real fuss about? And I think, as you correctly say, it's got a lot to do with them trying to sort of jawbone the markets. And also what it's pointing to me is that the cupboards, in terms of weaponry, are fairly light on. So they're not having to resort to what I call the Robbins Williams form of central banking. There used to be a skit that Robin Williams used to do in his stage act, which is being an English policeman. So he says to the thief, stop, stop, or I'll shout louder. And so basically that's what all the central banks are doing. Because look, what's the ammunition? You know, interest rates are pretty close to zero in most places. They are pumping in huge amounts of money, and the fiscal side is constrained. So I'm struggling to see what weapon of mass destruction or mass deception they can actually deploy. So to some extent, they're sort of trying to, and to be very fair, I'm not trying to say they've got an easy job. They're playing a bad hand reasonably well at the moment.
Well, I mean, they have the biggest bluff going on in history. You know, that's the fact. And, you know, unfortunately, everybody's bluffing back. You know,
exactly. And I think to some extent what we're seeing is actually kind of counterproductive, because the long end of the yield curve has backed up a huge amount.
Mm-hmm.
Mortgage rates have backed up a huge amount, all of which potentially risks destabilizing the recovery. People forget that banks are sitting on trillions of dollars of U.S. Treasury bonds. And as I understand it, the banks have done about $30 to $40 billion in losses on those portfolios.
Right.
And that's going to flow through into P&Ls at some point in time.
Yeah, and don't forget about the Fed has massive losses, although they'll somehow they'll spin it into a gain, let's be honest.
Well, they'll hold to maturity. You know the old saying that basically if it's a loss, it's a hold to maturity investment?
Right, exactly. Exactly, when it comes to bonds. No, but let's talk about what's happening in the emerging markets. For example, I think last week or the week before, I talked about some of the emerging markets. You look at Brazil, for example, which was the darling of investors for the longest time. Brazil just absolutely collapsed this year. Look at India. Their rupee has just gotten just cremated. You look at Australia, really kind of, okay, China, terrible. The Philippines went from, you know, up 30% or so to flat, and that has a lot to do with the differential in currencies. And what we're finding is there's a lot of this, which I've talked about for a long time, that, you know, the use of currencies to try to manipulate a market. And if it's one country, okay, because, and if it's not a major superpower or a super economy. But if you have the smaller countries that are trying to go along with the game plan of the bigger countries and the bigger economies, and then things turn, they could really get swallowed up pretty incredibly. And I do, by the way, blame a lot of the things that are going to happen and have been happening on Japan. Because I think what they did was the monster of evil, if you will, for general economies. And a lot of the recent moves on the upside for economies and the flushing in of cash and all that was good initially from a perspective of markets, if you will. But I think really going to be very difficult for them moving forward, especially because they have to raise taxes and they have a deadline to do so. If they don't do so, they're not going to be able to pay their debt service, right? I mean, tell me what I'm missing here.
I don't think you're missing much. Emerging markets have been one of my mysteries in my working career, because I think the investor love of emerging markets always reminds me pretty much of what they say about second marriages, a triumph of hope over experiences. And so basically, you know, all my life I've seen people go into emerging markets with all these wonderful statements and they all unwind badly. People forget that most of Latin America in the 1980s defaulted on their debt.
Yeah, we do forget that pretty easily, don't we?
Exactly. And people actually forget that in Asia, 97, 98 was a pretty bad period of history and took some of those economies 10, 12 years to recover. People forget that Russia defaulted in 1998, Argentina defaulted in 2001. And it's quite fascinating. I think Robert Louis Stevenson once said that financial markets have a grand memory for forgetting. And basically, that's what's happened. And what I think is, look, I'm not trying to say that all emerging markets are bad. And I think to some extent, some of the things that have happened in there were very healthy because they were able to compete for a period of time, because they had low labor costs, there was strong demand from emerging markets, and some of them, like Brazil, have resources. So they did very well. But after 2008, when the developed economy demand fell off, these countries have basically been using an old Western trick, which is credit. Mm-hmm. We've got double-digit credit growth in all these markets, and the debt levels have grown quite quickly in these markets in the last 5 or 6 years. So they've been using liquidity to pump up these economies. And what helped, as you correctly say, is the actual massive quantitative easing in the United States, Japan, UK, Switzerland. What that did was force down interest rates. To give you some idea, if you're a Brazilian company and you were borrowing in dollars, in 2002, you would have paid around 20-25% in interest rates. You're now, by 2012, end of 2012, you're paying 2.5%. Now, that's backed up because of the taper talk to 5. You know, Turkish dollar yields went down from double digits to 7 by the early sort of 2003, and they went down to just about 3%. Again, they backed up to 5. So all of that fed this massive credit bubble, which has basically covered up a lot of the sins. The best way to think of the emerging market story is this tide of liquidity sort of flowed in, and what you had was a very rocky beach with some very sharp rocks, but you couldn't see them because of the flood of water on top of them.
Right.
Now the tide's gone out, and everybody's now sort of saying, well, you know, these countries have structural problems, some of them have large... India's a classic example. If you take its state and federal government, they're running a budget deficit of somewhere between 7 and 8%. They've got a current account deficit of 6 to 7%. And they're completely reliant on external capital flows to balance the books. And suddenly that money is no longer there. And everybody's going, oh my God, there's problems. And then they look at things like corruption, ease of doing business, you know, the pace of regulatory reform, which in India, as you know, moves slower than a glacier. So basically all of that has been exposed, and I keep saying to these guys, but you know, this has always been the case, it's not new. So, you know, what are we looking at for the last 5 years? So people sort of now have had the sort of scales removed from their eyes, and they're going, these places have problems. And to some extent the emerging market problem has been brewing for 12 to 15 months, because we've seen growth peel off. I mean, Brazil's gone to pretty much zero, China's gone to 7-ish, India's gone from double digits to, say, 4. You know, Russia's gone to under 2. So it's not a pretty picture in that sort of sense.
Right.
And so this liquidity withdrawal is just making it worse. And, you know, I love people. They have a way of rationalizing everything. So, you know, the sell-side analysts are saying, oh, look, this time it's different. And I'm sitting there, I think I've heard this song before somewhere. And they're saying, oh, but the debt's not in foreign currencies. I'm saying, look, guys, debt is debt. Yeah, it doesn't matter which currency it's in, and besides which, a lot of that debt is held by foreign investors,
right.
And with the weak currencies, they're going to start to bail out, and that's basically going to push up yields. So I think there's going to be a period of great pressure, and I think all the people who coined phrases like BRICS have now got a new one called BITS, which is Brazil, India, Indonesia, Turkey, and South Africa, because they all have budget deficits, large current account deficits, external funding needs, and falling reserves very sharply. So I think we are going to see a lot of stress. Now, how bad it gets, I just don't know as yet.
Right. You know, I think that it's, you know, if you think about the way you've talked about the developed countries and what's happened, and then look at the emerging countries and what's happened, I think that we can, in a way, think of very loosely the car business and what happened there. You know, you had the automobile business in the U.S. that was just burgeoning, doing great, but they were, you know, behind the scenes, things were a problem. You know, the basic architecture of how they were doing things, the financing, what they were doing, very easy credit they were giving away, if you recall, You know, they were making product, but okay, it started to back up. But then what happened is, let me just continue. Then the suppliers are the equivalent of the emerging markets. You know, the suppliers to all the things. And when things are good with the car companies, well, the suppliers are doing well. But the suppliers then all of a sudden get cut off like the emerging markets did because of demand destruction back in the, 2007, 2008, 2009. And the suppliers, many of them either went out of business, had to merge, started using credit to try to sustain and to keep themselves afloat. Same thing that's happening with the emerging markets. So I kind of see that supply chain very similar. Would you agree?
Yes, no, I agree. I think it's a very, very good analogy. And I always remember wondering why companies like General Motors didn't go bankrupt quicker. Mm-hmm. And the answer was they transferred all the bankruptcy risk to all the suppliers. And basically all the supplying companies in the chain went bankrupt first. Mm-hmm. And eventually it gets to General Motors. And I think that's a very, very good way of thinking about the relationship. And it's actually quite amusing. The IMF in its latest global growth forecast have now said, completely contrary to what they said about 6 to 12 months ago, where they said emerging markets would power the global economy. Now they're saying, no, we didn't really mean that. We mean the developed economies are now going to power the economy.
Well, they have.
Could you make up your mind?
Well, they also said what's really interesting. They're another one on the stimulus bandwagon that warned countries of removing stimulus prematurely.
Indeed.
So, and now everybody's on the same bandwagon that we are force fed. I don't think there's a time, because investor memory is so short for everybody, myself. Two, the fact is that, do you remember a time when there wasn't such activity with the Fed? I mean, almost on a daily basis. And the preoccupation of markets and of media with the Fed, it's really gotten to a point that it's clouded the entire investment process. But that's we've kind of beat that to crap, so let's move on. What's going on in Germany? We have an interesting election coming up. Merkel is going to up for re-election. And one of the things I thought was very interesting was her comment. One of her opening comments in her election campaign, the beginning, was that Greece should have never been allowed to be in the euro in the first place. Obviously appealing and appeasing to her constituency that, we don't want to be paying and bailing out these bad countries anymore.
Well, I think, firstly, the German election campaign has been, to be putting it politely, one of the most boring campaigns. They had a campaign debate between Peer Steinbrück, her major opposition, and Angela Merkel, and the winner was voted one of the questioners. So that gives you an idea of the level of debate. So basically, it's a non-issue. I think the Angela Merkel will return as a chancellor. Mm-hmm. Big question is what sort of coalition backs her up, because nobody will get absolute power. So I think it'll be interesting, but everybody's assuming and has assumed for some time that after the election, somehow miraculously, people will start to deal with the European problem. Mm. And I actually think they're going to be in for a rude shock, because I think nothing much is going to happen. And by saying that Greece shouldn't have been allowed in, isn't that like bolting the barn door after the horse is in the next county?
Mm-hmm.
So, you can't throw Greece out. So basically, now the problem is, okay, well, what do we do? And I think the big problem for Europe is, if they wanted to resolve this, they should have cut these countries loose when it was patently obvious they weren't going to basically be able to pay back the debt. So I'll tell you what's going to happen with Greece. Greece needs more money, we all know that. But the problem is they can't do debt write-offs. Because if they do debt write-offs, because 90% of all Greek debt is now held either by central banks or bailout funds or the IMF. So if you actually do a haircut, you're not going to hurt commercial investors now because they don't own any. You're going to actually have write-downs at the ECB and places like that, which will immediately lead to checks having to be cut to recapitalize these institutions. So I don't think that's going to happen. And they're already playing games about how they can give this money to the European Union budget. They're talking about extending the loans to 30 years with no interest, all sorts of games. So that's not the real issue, because we all know none of this debt will come back. The real thing is how Europe is going to play out. And I think people over the last 12 months have gotten themselves into a very false sense of security. And that's been underwritten by three things. First, is everybody thought this austerity program, the so-called growth and stability pact, with everybody bringing their budget deficits down and their debt down, was making some progress. The problem is we know nobody's made any progress, debt's gone up, budget deficits are still there, they're lower. And so what's going to actually happen or what has already happened is people are asking for extensions and so forth. So that plank has fallen away. The second thing is the famous statement by Mario Draghi about I'll do whatever it takes and his famous outright monetary transactions, which is basically a money printing operation to support the efforts of governments to raise money. But the funny thing is, everybody keeps saying what a success this program has been, except it's never been used.
Never. That's the funny thing. Right.
Yeah, and I'm sitting there going, how can you know it's... I actually don't know how it's going to work in practice. And the problem now is, the two people who probably would need to use it, which is Spain and Italy, for political reasons, are in no shape to do it. And that's particularly because both the governments in Spain and Italy have internal problems. Spain is mired in a bribery scandal, and Italy's government depends on whether, you know, Silvio Berlusconi can be exempted from everything so he doesn't have to actually do time in jail. And if he doesn't get that, then the government could fall. So I don't think anything's going to happen. So that plank is not there. And don't forget, the German Constitutional Court is looking at it and will report in September. And I don't know what they'll say, but basically that could throw a monkey wrench into this process. The last element was the famous banking union, which is going to prop up all the banks. European banks have about a trillion euros, 1.4, 1.3 trillion US dollars worth of losses. And basically this was going to be the grand plan to save the banking system, a la the TARP package. Except there's a problem. Any banking system, if you're going to properly regulate it, needs a deposit insurance scheme and a recapitalization process. And that involves somebody putting real money on the table, which has to be Germany. And Germany flatly has said they won't. So the banking union has gone from being the grand plan to break the link between sovereigns, because they own a lot of sovereign debt, and the banks, to one where they're now talking about slightly diluting the link. And the Germans have been very, very interesting in this, because they were the ones who wanted the banking union. Once they realized they were going to have to write the check, they sort of weaseled backwards and backwards. And this is a consistent pattern of how Germany's behaved. So all those three planks are coming undone. And at the same time, we have countries like Ireland, Portugal, who have to go back to commercial markets or extend their loans. Greece will need more money. So all the pressures are building, and the real economies in terms of unemployment look very doggy. So the pressure's going to come on, and the problem is Germany is now absolutely, totally caught between a rock and a hard place. So if they try to cut Greece loose, they'll take a loss. If they don't, then they'll have to keep tipping money into this endless sort of black hole to try to keep the game going. And either way, they're going to have a problem. And as we've discussed before, the German economy is not as strong as people think it is. And one of the fundamental things I'll sort of illustrate to you is everybody says what a great exporting power it is. So I actually went and broke down all their exports. They run about a 20, 25 billion euro shortfall to Libya, Norway, and Russia, which is their energy imports. They actually run a deficit with China and Japan. The only actual surplus they have is with the rest of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And their two biggest export markets are Spain and Italy.
Right.
So basically, they're trapped. They can't get out of this.
Well, and that's why they have to keep the whole situation rolling. I mean, you know, it's until the juggler misses a ball, that's when it all starts falling down. And so far, the idea of having a central banker who, for whatever reason, holds so much power and yields so much ability to move markets and to control things with just commentary and promises, because, you know, precedent has been that, of course, it would be used like the United States to bail things out. And we have seen that there have been a tremendous amount of previous bank recapitalization, or at least re-engineering of the balance sheets. But I do agree with you, and it is a wonder to me that the stock markets in generally in those countries have done extremely well. As a matter of fact, there was a report out earlier this week that talked about last month's flows of funds and ETFs, that there was a significant withdrawal from both bonds and from equities around the world, pretty much, but the only one that really had a plus was Europe.
Indeed, and the European stock markets, particularly the German, French markets, have done very, very well, but the peripheral markets have rallied hugely on the stability. And in my view, nothing really has changed. We've managed to sort of pull a rug over the problems. But at some point in time, the markets are going to test all this. And when they test all this, I think they'll find that the emperor, as we all know, or in this case, the empress, which is Chancellor Merkel, has no clothes.
No clothes, and I don't want to think
and
about that for
of
too
Angela
long.
Merkel without any clothes
no,
is something I can't take.
Nothing
at
that. No, there are definitely alternatives to that that I would prefer. Let's kind of just go back to one other thing, and I want to focus in on some of the commodity markets. You know, we've seen that there has been a tremendous amount of volatility. Now, whether that's due to some discussion of liquidity coming out of the markets, or whether it's because there has been, you know, all these different news items, it doesn't really affect stocks as much. I mean, you know, you look at the food markets. I mean, just between soybeans and corn, you can watch that go crazy. But put that aside. Look at oil. Oil at 108, 109. We got the Syrian issue that seems to be dragging out. You wonder whether or not, frankly, and this may be a little bit odd to most, but whether or not the U.S. is waiting till after the high holidays of the Jewish holidays. And one of the reasons is because Israel is right in the middle of it. And right now, you know, we have the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur holiday for the next week or so. And maybe, you know, it's being polite not to involve them in a war during this time. You know, or at least they won't be as effective. And maybe that's why this whole thing is stalling. The interesting move by President Obama to allow or to ask or to off the decision on the Congress. But, you know, you see this movement, and it's really been very disruptive to countries like Australia, hasn't it?
I think the commodity story is a very interesting one. Clearly, there are certain natural factors in supply and demand, like weather, which has obviously been disruptive to certain food crops. The second is obviously the geopolitical uncertainty around Syria. But I think one of the most amusing things about Syria, sadly, is that if you kill 200,000 people with conventional weapons, that doesn't cause any problems.
Yeah.
If you kill 200 people with chemical weapons, it brings on the wrath of the international community on you, which is kind of an interesting piece of hypocrisy. But then, I think, is the real story. And the real story is the slowdown in China and the slowdown in emerging markets, which is clearly having an effect on commodity prices. But I've always said that this commodity so-called super cycle was a bit of a nonsense, because what really happened was in the 1990s, real prices of commodities were very low and nobody invested. So when emerging market demand came on stream, there was no supply. But now we have the double whammy that the demand seems to be leveling off, but all the investment in new supply is coming on stream. So I think the story for commodity producers, particularly in places like Brazil, Australia, Canada, and South Africa, is not particularly good, because firstly, they're not going to get the demand, prices are going to be very weak, and if you haven't already got your financing lined up, you're going to have some difficulty. And just anecdotally, what we're hearing in Australia is that the second-tier miners are having trouble getting financing, and so a lot of projects are being put on hold. But the other thing is, we're seeing bankruptcy among a lot of what we call mining services companies. These are people who do work for mining companies, and they've got problems, which is actually suggesting to me that the commodity prices are going to be a lot weaker. And the other thing is, the higher commodity prices, which is kind of paradoxical in this environment, has basically meant that global growth may get choked off.
Right. No, I agree with you. And that's a double-edged sword that you're mentioning. You know, you have the fact that commodity prices need to be higher for some of these companies and some of these countries that are commodity-dependent, commodity-rich to do well. At the same time, we don't want commodities to go up because, or at least certain commodities to go up, because that could be problematic to the input costs, which we are seeing dropping, by the way. But at the same time, I always find it fascinating that when oil prices go up, and then vis-a-vis you have the gasoline prices go up, that economists say that, you know, the higher gasoline prices really don't have an effect on consumers. It really, you know, they keep spending. But yet when gasoline prices come down, they say, hey, this is good. There's more money in the consumer pocket to buy things.
Well, I find it difficult to believe that higher gasoline prices are something that's not going to affect the economy. Everything we buy has to be moved around. And so basically, by definition, that's going to flow through the supply chain and push up prices. And clearly, unless you get income growth on the other side, which we're not seeing, I don't see how that can have anything but a detrimental effect on the economy. So I just don't buy that.
I hear you. Well, listen, as always, a pleasure to talk with you, and great insight, great information, and just a real pleasant time to really understand more about what's happening in all these different areas. And I really want to thank you very much. And hopefully one of these days I will get down there. I was close. I was in Morocco recently. I was getting over there. But not close
enough. Morocco is very close.
Yeah, well.
It's only about 12 hours in a plane.
Yeah, I mean, I was halfway there already. I could have continued east on my camel.
You could have continued east on, and I would have seen you around here about 2020.
Exactly. Das, thanks so much for having
it's my pleasure, Andrew. Good luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye. He's like a breath of fresh air, isn't he? I always say that when I talk to him, I get so relaxed. Even though I probably talk pretty fast throughout the whole thing, it's just very relaxing talking to Das, his tonality and the information that he brings. And that's what I like about him so much, because he has a point and he's able to very, very clearly and very calmly explain it. Anyway, I'll mention just on closing again that we do have the webinar on this Thursday coming up. You can go over to triggercharts.com/events and see all of the webinars coming up. You need to pre-register. Space is limited. And we have a good amount of people that have already signed up for it. But you can check that out. It's going to be a half hour talking about the altimeter, which is a market profile-based indicator, which takes much of what you know about the markets right now and turns it a bit of on its side. You'll see what I mean about that when we talk about it on Thursday. So make sure to check that out right there. And of course, the rest of them are on there as well. If you have any questions, you know how to contact me simply at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Listen to DH Unplugged this week. Apple is our closest to the pin. That is a contest that we're doing. You have to find what the price is going to be at a certain date, and you'll find what happened and who is the winner with IBM from last week. It's a prize that we give away and all that. Kind of cool. A lot of fun. But take a look and watch Japan. Watch how the currency reacts to the note and approval of the Olympics. What you would think should happen probably won't. We think it's going to happen is that there'll be a bid to their currency, but probably the opposite will happen. Usually you would think that a country that gets the Olympics or that has good news moves their currency higher, but things are a little bit upside down in Japan as well. Actually, good news moves the yen the other way. Why? Because that is the impact of what's happening with government intervention these days. And that is really all that we're seeing across the board, continuation of currencies being quote-unquote manipulated or intervened with in order to get a country where they need to be from an import-export stance, which really isn't working that well for Japan. It's helping things, no question about it. It's bringing up profitability because the yen has really moved down so much. But you still have to wonder what's happening there in terms of how long that can be sustained, and what is the right price. Very close to about 100 right now on the yen to the dollar. Oil prices will also be in focus this week. I will tell you that at 110, it's starting to get ridiculous. For a long time, about $10 or $12, I have been wrong. We covered the position, but I've been wrong about oil, and much of my research did not include the potential for a Mideast war, I'll be honest with you. You know, it was based on the fundamentals and inventories. It was based on trends. This kind of took the whole entire thesis and just blew it out. And it's interesting to note and important to note that when that happens, you have to go along with it. Don't keep on pressing in one direction if, in fact, you believe that something is going to happen and it doesn't. You have to change when the times change. Anyway, thanks for joining me. We'll be back next week with another great guest. And, of course, check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com and follow me on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz. Lots of information coming out. And we're going to hopefully give you some updates on Stocktoberfest that will be happening next month and give you the opportunity to bring in your stocks that we can analyze for you throughout the month of October. Give you a bit of an update. Lots going on here, so trying to make sure we have time to do it all and be efficient. Thanks for joining me again. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.